78. This is now talking with Norm Broughton on 7 August 78 at IRSI in Helsinki. Well, could you tell me, first of all, what your educational background was and when you first came in contact with radio astronomy?
Well, I have a BSc in radio physics, and it was during the summer job at the National Research Council that I came in contact with radio astronomy. I worked the summer for Mr. Covington.
In Ottawa.
In the solar radio work that she was doing then. I guess that started me off. I got intensely interested in it, and then I went and worked there after graduation of BSc.
And that would be what year then? 1950.
That's right.
Oh, I see. So you were there 4 years before this first publication here
in radio astronomy,
the science anyway.
Right.
And what did you work on in those
In the first few years, I worked on instrumentation to improve the equipment, which was, of course, very marginal, being old radar equipment and that. And gradually developed up into something more reliable.
And what were the primary needs for solar radio astronomy instrumentation at that point?
Well, solar microwave radiation at 10 centimeters, which incidentally has been going continuously since 1947, and the longest continuous series of solar radio records with high accuracy, and I suspect will replace the Zurich sunspot numbers as the index of solar activity, requires reliable instrumentation which can operate continuously without any problems.
So reliability was more concern to you than the usual radio astronomy. You always want to be reliable, of course, but it was even more concern to you.
Reliability and accuracy. I mean, I had to make sure that everything was very linear, so our results would carry on from one epoch to the other.
Mm-hmm. Well, just bringing up that point of accuracy, in fact, I interviewed Tanaka a few days ago, and he was talking about their monitoring effort versus the Canadian one, and both of them showed the same long-term changes, but that there was a 10% sort of difference. And his claim was that indeed the Covington group was off by 10%. Do you agree with that in terms of these values through the 50s?
I think you'd have to ask that question to Mr. Covington.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. You haven't kept up with it. You're not
a story.
My feeling is that that the Ottawa records are pretty reliable, but there is a slight frequency difference between Tanaka's measurement and the solar measurement and the Ottawa measurement, and there may very well be a spectral difference in this.
Yeah. Well, 10%, of course, is a very small amount, nevertheless. Okay, so
the Nagoya measurements at 3,700 agree much better with the Ottawa records than the Tokyo ones.
I see.
So there's some difference in Japan itself.
Okay, well, that was just an aside.
Right.
But as you were working on the instrumentation, apparently you became interested in the astronomy also.
Right.
And what were your main interests in solar radio astronomy?
Well, 1954, we had operating the first instrument, which is capable of resolving the sun at 10 centimeters. We put into operation a 150-foot waveguide array, which had a beam width of 8 minutes of arc. And so we were able with that to get our first, if you like, synthesis of what the solar temperature was from the strip scans on the sun. And about the same time, the Christensen's group in Australia produced their 21-centimeter measurement of the solar distribution.
Did these give similar results? Or?
Yes, quite similar. There is a wavelength difference between 21-centimeter and 10-centimeter, and their brightness temperature is a factor of 2.5, so higher than what the 10-centimeter one is.
But I mean in terms of the...
As you would expect. You're higher in the solar atmosphere.
But I mean in terms of the qualitative distribution of the sun, for instance, limb brightening, right?
Oh, yes. Essentially, as to what was predicted from the series of limb brightening. Limb brightening increases as you get into shorter and shorter wavelengths. And in fact, it really becomes noticeable down in the millimeter and centimeter range.
Mm-hmm. But you did detect it with this?
We do detect some in writing, yes.
But at this stage?
And falling off at the polar regions, yes. Yeah. Brightening on the equatorial, yes.
Another note I have here from an abstract is that the equator was found to be brighter than the pole.
Yes, that's right.
Now, how could you determine that? Did you have a north-south fan beam?
No, it was an east-west fan beam. Of course, the sun does change its inclination with time, mm-hmm. plus or minus 26 degrees, which gives you some resolution that way. And it's a modeling technique that has to be used in anything like this. And we divided the sun up into segments to fit our results.
I see. Yeah. Where did the idea for a slotted wave guide, as far as I know, that's still is unique in radio astronomy?
The idea came from World War II, where slotted waveguide arrays were used for radar. And the National Research Council developed this early in the 1940s for World War II.
Were you part of the wartime radar?
No, I wasn't. I was in the Air Force overseas at the time. But it was just an extension of that then into something very much bigger and longer for solar work, which was carried on by Mr. Covington. Well, perhaps instigated it, but the chap who did the work was now off at University of Syracuse.
And who is
Dr. Harry Grunberg.
Grunberg?
Yeah.
But is that not true that I don't think anyone even since has used slotted waveguides?
No, that is true. The
They're
fairly complex to build to get any degree of resolution. And they have no gain in the center, in the north-south dimension. They were just radiate out from slots. It's perhaps much easier to build interferometers.
A bunch of small dishes.
Which was our next step, to add on to this slotted waveguide array for parabolic cylinders, each with slotted waveguide feeds, give the same squint angle as the other had, and then form what we call, and has been called since, a compound interferometer.
Right. And this was, it said it gave you a 2 arc minute by 2 degree beam in the abstract. I guess the 2 degrees now is the limitation due to the small dishes.
2 degrees is the north-south resolution, that's the small parabolic cylinders, the weren't dishes.
Oh, I see.
And 2 minutes is the resolution we got from extending on the compound system.
And what did this enable you to find out about the sun? That
it confirmed, of course, what we've been found with the 8-minute of arc slotted waveguide array, that the radio emissions were associated with plage areas of the sun, which are overlying sunspot regions. It enabled us to get better resolution on the limb and see radio spots emerging before they're optically visible. I suppose that is probably the major sort of contribution of that resolution. And in fact, the array has since been extended into, not with the slotted waveguide, but an array of dishes up at Algonquin now, where we have an interferometer which has 1 minute of arc by 2 degrees.
I see.
And takes daily strip scans of the sun, which are published in the Quarterly Journal of Solar Activity.
How long has that been going on?
Well, that's been going on since about 1966, 67, too.
Since just about when the big dish was.
About the same time, yeah.
Why was it that your resolution went for, you had 8 arc minutes with the 150-foot slotted waveguide and 2 arc minutes with the compound interferometer?
That's a feature of the compound system, which is what Mr. Covington and I pioneered at that time, was that if you add on another element, the same length, and you multiply the two together, you get the interference between the phase centers of the two elements, which now gives you twice the resolution that you get if you just had that same aperture.
So you get
extending the array by another 150 feet, giving us 4 minutes of arc.
Right, and then you get the doubling effect.
But taking them separately and adding on the phase, multiplying now through the phase centers, you get the 2 minutes of arc.
I see.
That principle is still used. It's being used by Christensen's group in Australia in the first telescope. Stanford has used it in their array before they closed it down. We've done some work on our array in Algonquin whereby we get 15 seconds of arc resolution by compound system.
So this was the first compound interferometer?
This was the first compound interferometer.
Are there any special difficulties with operating it when you have different kinds of elements?
Yeah, there's special difficulties in any complex antenna system, and the particular one in this one is to keep all the phasings right and all the phase lengths right in these systems. If your antennas get somewhat off phase, and you get phase errors in the system, and you can get patterns which aren't nice Sanex over X patterns.
But more so than a regular interferometer?
Yes, more so than a regular interferometer.
And why is that now?
Well, because you're multiplying two phase antennas together. Now,
yes,
the phase between them slips a little bit, then
it's more critical, yes.
And it slips away from being a Sanex over X.